Shrink Wrap Radio. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make you dangerous.
Shrink Wrap Radio number 112, Psychology and Consumer Culture, September 23rd, 2007. Welcome to Shrink Wrap Radio, the planet's premier psychology podcast. This is your host, Dr. Dave, coming to you from the San Francisco Bay Area. Shrink Wrap Radio is the show that speaks from the psychologist in me to the psychologist in you, whether you be amateur, student, or professional.
The Bratz-Dahls have to do with selling sexuality, basically, to preteen girls and boys, with the girls being a bigger target here. And that, of course, is getting younger and younger and younger, so that you have Disney mermaids on toddlers' underwear, and you have a thong underwear that's sized for 7-year-old girls. And it just goes on and on. And these girls are not any more sophisticated on an emotional level sexually than girls were 20 or 200 years ago, but they do know that it's something that older girls and adults do, and there's a lot of taboo around it, so it's all very exciting, and of course they're attracted to it. But the message is a very sexist one, which is basically, your worth is tied to how sexy you are.
That was the voice of my guest, Alan D. Kanner, Ph.D. Alan Kanner is co-founder of the Campaign for a Commercial-Free Childhood, co-editor of the books Psychology and Consumer Culture and Eco-Psychology. He's also a Berkeley, California-based child, family, and adult psychologist. He's a leading figure in the field of eco-psychology and has written extensively about the commercialization of childhood. Recently, Alan has started writing a column for Tikkun magazine on the corporatized society. Now, here's the interview. Dr. Alan Kanner, welcome to Shrink Wrap Radio.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
Well, it's great to have you. And I know that you've been very active in trying to get psychology to take a stand against the growth of corporate marketing to children. And before we get into the role that APA and psychology as a profession might play, I'd like to have you take us through the problem as you see it. What's the issue here around the marketing to children?
Sure. The issue, in a certain way, is why do we need to do it at all? The huge amount of marketing to children that we are now witnessing is a fairly new phenomenon. It didn't really get going until the mid-80s, when marketers discovered that children had far more discretionary income and far more influence on their parents' spending than anyone had imagined. And then from that point on, it's just skyrocketed, so that in 1983, the U.S. companies spent about $100 million advertising to children. In 2005, the figure had reached $16.8
billion. Wow, that, talk about a skyrocketing change of budget. That's a pretty big difference.
Yes, and so while that was going on, the amount that children have been spending and the amount that their parents have been spending has also been steadily and dramatically climbing, so that figure in the United States, in terms of how much children are spending or influencing, is now about $600 billion, and worldwide it's over $1 trillion. So this is not a trivial amount of money that we're talking about anymore. In the meantime, the marketing itself was initially aimed at teenagers, and it's gotten younger and younger. So then it went to preteens, or what the marketers call tweens. That's the term they made up, and that's roughly age 6 to 14. And much more recently, in the last 2 or 3 years, it's dipped down now into infants and toddlers, with the youngest targets being about 4 months old.
Now, how can you market to a four-month-old? are you talking about the marketing that's being beamed at parents in terms of like baby Mozart and, you know, trying to get parents to enrich their child's environment?
Well, the videos that are being sold for infants and toddlers are, and also some of the TV shows and cable programs that are out there, are aimed at children predominantly from 6 months on up to around 2 years, or sometimes as young as 4 months. What the marketers are learning from their research is that children can recognize logos that young, and then when they begin to speak, this is, they start to ask for McDonald's and other products. So the capacity to start to influence young, very young children is perhaps shockingly low, but it's there, and the marketers have gone for it in quite a gung-ho fashion. So the question then becomes, well, there's of course several questions, but one of the main questions is this fair? Marketers are these very skilled, intelligent people with huge resources at their command, and they are manipulating youngsters, and certainly youngsters who are 1 or 2 years old, I mean, they don't have a chance. And as we know from cognitive research, young kids until they're about 8 or 9 don't even have the capacity to understand what a persuasive argument is all about. And that means that they don't understand the intention of somebody who's trying to sell something to them. They just simply believe them, and they don't fathom the manipulation, and they're cognitively not really prepared to do that yet. And of course, that's only one kind of manipulation that we're talking about. And even as we get up into 14, 15, 16 year olds, they are less cognitively sophisticated than adults. So that's one big question. Is it fair to be doing this, for these adults to be coming at children with everything that they have and in rather unscrupulous ways? So that now, you know, we're even getting buzz marketing, as it's called, a kind of a marketing where children don't even know they're being advertised to.
What did you call that?
Buzz marketing.
Buzz, okay, buzz. It's buzz or stealth marketing, okay.
Stealth, yeah. They have different terms. So that there's a company called the Girls Intelligence Agency.
I was fascinated by that. I read an article that you wrote called Globalization and the Commercialization of Childhood. And in there, you talk about the GIA, which sounds like the CIA. Go ahead and tell us about that.
So what the GIA does is basically it's hired by corporations that want to introduce products to girls. And it has a group of girls around the country, which it calls its agents, and they range from, I don't know, 6 to 11 years old or so. They don't get paid by the company, but they get some free products, and what they do is they set up slumber parties for up to about 11 of their friends and pass out the free products to their friends. Meanwhile, taking notes on their friends' reactions to the products and on other things their friends are talking about, such as, you know, who's popular right now, or what are the girls really interested in. So basically, these girls are spying on their friends in order to help GIA and the people who hire GIA introduce their products. And this is the kind of stealth marketing now that is becoming more and more popular. And as I said, it's a very severe manipulation in that the kids don't even know that they're being sold to. They think they're going over to a friend's party because a friend likes them once they're there.
Yeah, wow. I know the same kinds of techniques are being brought to bear against adult populations.
Yeah.
And GIA is probably a marketing strategy, research kind of company. Because of my own involvement in the world of market research, I'm familiar with some of this kind of thing where a company like that will have a panel. So it sounds like they have, you know, what they would call a panel of really young girls – and to engage in this sort of stealth marketing that you're talking about, or buzz marketing, which, you know, is even questionable with adults, I have to say. But I agree with you about the questionability of when you start applying this to young kids who haven't reached the stage in their cognitive development to have any kind of critical facility. And your story of the GIA reminds me of a time when I was in Chicago some years ago, actually to do market research, and I stumbled into a huge department store there that I'd never heard of, but it looked kind of interesting, so I went inside, and it was called American Girl. And it was this huge department store totally dedicated to a line of dolls called the American Girl doll. And they had clothing ensembles that the little girls and the dolls could wear the same clothing. And I think the girls' mommies could wear the same clothing, you know, so that the whole, quotes, family could wear the same clothing and have the same accessories. And they had all of these, what they would call lifestyle areas around this concept, and a restaurant where they could have tea parties, and the place was absolutely packed. This was some years ago, and it sounds like what you're describing is it's being ratcheted up ever more.
Yes, and the largest selling doll now is called the Bratz doll. It's outselling Barbie, and they're very sexualized figures that are being sold or marketed to young girls. So it's
well, they look like little hookers, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's what they've been described that way, as tramps.
Yeah.
And so there's a whole slew of what I consider content areas of marketing, and by that I mean what is being marketed, that is basically bad for kids. And if you take the six or seven largest kinds of items or areas of sales that exist, you'll find that every single one of them is bad for children. So the most well-known and what children buy the most of is junk food. And now, of course, we have an obesity crisis in this country.
Yes.
With a rise in not just obesity, but obesity-related diseases such as diabetes and of course, a rise in cavities and a host of other illnesses, and that's just one of them. Another area is violence. So there's been a huge explosion, not just of the amount of violent media being sold to mostly, you know, primarily to boys, but how gruesome the videos and the movies and whatnot are. The degree of violence keeps getting worse, as it were, because the companies keep trying to outdo each other to get the boys' attention. The Bratz dolls have to do with selling sexuality, basically, to preteen girls and boys, with the girls being a bigger target here. And that, of course, is getting younger and younger and younger, so that you have Disney mermaids on toddlers' underwear, and you have a thong underwear that's sized for 7-year-old girls, and it just goes on and on. And these girls are not any more sophisticated on an emotional level sexually than girls were 20 or 200 years ago. But they do know that it's something that older girls and adults do, and there's a lot of taboo around it. So it's all very exciting, and of course they're attracted to it. But the message is a very sexist one, which is basically your worth is tied to how sexy you are. And so
how paradoxical that should be happening on the heels of the whole feminist revolution that we supposedly went through.
Right. And in fact, the feminist revolution is kind of slipped into this in a distorted way, because this is the kind of loosening up. You're prude if you object to this kind of marketing. And there's a phrase that the marketers use, that kids are getting older, younger, KGO. Why? I think in the case of the girls, it could be that the kids are getting objectified younger. But the idea there is that the marketers are seeing that children are much more sophisticated than they used to be, and therefore it takes a much more sophisticated kind of advertising to reach them. If we unpack what sophisticated means, we find out that it means manipulative. That it takes much more subtle manipulation now to get to these kids who, to some degree, have become skeptical or cynical about marketing because they've been exposed to so much of it. But it's the marketer's fault that this is happening at all, and it's not like the children are getting sophisticated in any kind of desirable way. They're becoming more cynical about the public world and what they're exposed to there. And if it's getting more difficult to get to them, it's certainly not so difficult that the marketers are failing, because as I was mentioning, every year the amount of children are spending is going up. So, these adults can continue to fool the kids, even as the kids, become a little bit better at seeing through what's going on. But do we want our children to feel the cynicism? Do we want them to mistrust the public or the adult world that surrounds them? And is this something as a society that we want to sanction so that these companies can make bigger profits?
Yeah, you talk about the commercialization of childhood, and the kind of childhood that you're describing is so different than the childhood that I came up in which, I played in vacant lots and we played baseball and hide and seek and kick the can and relatively innocent pastimes such as that. And of course we had sports heroes and wanted to buy trading cards with their pictures and ate cereals and so that we could get the little prizes that were inside the box. But it does seem like things have really gotten scaled up. And so when you talk about the commercialization of childhood, I think you've been touching on this. Maybe the question is redundant, but what do you mean by that phrase?
Yeah, what I'm saying right now is, as one of my colleagues, Susan Lynn, likes to say, children are being marketed to from the time they get up to the time they go to bed. And so the assault, which has moved from Saturday morning cartoons and cereal boxes, which is what we grew up with, to just about every aspect of children's lives, anytime they go to a public place where people expect them to show up, there'll be a lot of marketing aimed at children, and it could be a concert, a circus. It doesn't matter what it is. They'll be inundated now with marketing. Marketing has made huge roads in our schools, and I could certainly talk some more about that. But the overarching point is that it's just constant and it's ubiquitous and it's increasingly sophisticated, so that these children are growing up with the message that if you're going to be happy, you need to buy all these things and continue to buy. And there's a whole set of materialistic values being inculcated in this respect in a way that just wasn't happening before.
Let me ask you, just to back up a little bit, how did you come to be interested in this as an issue?
A number of years back, I was very involved in helping get an area of psychology, eco-psychology, off the ground. And one of the questions I was very concerned about as an eco-psychologist was why are we destroying the planet? And from a psychological perspective, and most environmentalists would agree that the two major forces behind environmental destruction are first-world consumerism and the population explosion. in terms of the first world consumerism, to kind of clean up our own act before we look at others, what I was then wondering about is, well, there's a long tradition of research that's now gone on in many, many countries that shows that once people's basic needs for, you know, clothing and housing and whatnot are met, there's very little relationship then with how much money they have or how wealthy they are and how happy they are. So it's not making people happier to accumulate all this stuff. So the question I was wondering is, well, why? And that brought me to the marketing. And I was interested in adults also, but as I was looking into this, I'm a child and family therapist. It was near the time when this marketing to kids was taking off, and so I became very concerned about what I was seeing there as well.
You talk about you talk about many countries, and you say this is happening in other countries, and you actually link it to the process of globalization. Maybe you can say something about that.
Yeah, I'd be happy to. Economic globalization, which is being driven by these international organizations like the WTO, the World Trade Organization, and the World Bank, is basically an attempt to allow multinational corporations to go into any country they want around the world and to sell their products without any interference from the local or the national government. And so anything that does interfere is considered a barrier to trade, such as a tariff, and is being dismantled, as it were, by the WTO and these other organizations. So as this brand of capitalism, the corporate capitalism, is spreading, and the economic system is spreading, part of what's happening is as well that national corporations are bringing in their marketing to children into India and China and Brazil and these other huge and relatively untapped markets. So we're seeing in all these countries many more TV stations devoted to children and much more marketing in general aimed at young populations. And so we're starting to see the same pattern of the spending going up, both in the marketing and how much the children are spending or influencing. All of this is happening much faster than it did in the United States because the corporations already have everything in place. They have their market research, and they have the media all set up to go in. So the whole process is happening much more quickly. And as I was mentioning earlier, a meta message of advertising, and this is true for adults too, but it certainly is children, is that materialism is the way to happiness. But with the big corporation is doing the vast majority of the marketing, what we're really getting is a much more specific message, which is that it's corporate products that are the key to happiness in life. It's not just any old stuff, any mm-hmm. old material goods. It's the Nikes, and it's the McDonald's, and Nintendo. It's the corporate sheen or image that goes along with the product. So very often, and this is called branding, the kids are as interested or more interested in owning the corporation's product than the product itself. Over time, what kids bring from this is the idea that they need corporations in order to be happy. They need this giant economic system that's taken over the world right now, And this is a good thing. It's what's one part of the image that's being sold is that the world is going to be united through all of us having this same running shoe.
Yeah, the united faces of Benetton, or the united colors of Benetton, that brings to mind as one There's example of that.
It's a utopian image that if we all own the same thing, this is how they attain world peace and paradise. But
we're seeing this terrible. I had to drive to Stockton the other day, about a 3-hour drive, and it was exactly the same in Stockton as it is in my neighborhood here. The same chains. There was, they offered to take me out to lunch, and they said, "Would you like to go to Chili's or to Applebee's or to?" And they were the same dreadful chains that are in my neighborhood. And it doesn't matter if I drive to Stockton or if I drive to Kansas, I'm going to be encountering the same elements of what is increasingly, seems to me, like a monoculture virus that's spreading across the face of the earth, where there's a sterile, deadening sameness. What's the point of travel if it's all the same?
Exactly. So the monoculture is a commercial monoculture. It's based on the products of these multinational corporations. And I would agree with you that to the extent that they're successful, they're going to homogenize the world's cultures, or the differences are going to be kind of trivial. And as I also was mentioning, children are growing up with this image as an exciting future, that we're all going to own the same computer, we're all going to be buying the same clothes. And this is a cutting edge for the human race. And I'm saying that whether it's intentional or not, one of the effects beyond all these bad products that are being marketed to children is this meta message that economic globalization, the monoculture, is the answer to our prayers.
And I guess, some people would regard you as unpatriotic for even saying that, because we're told that our economic survival, our very survival, is dependent upon us having a well-functioning marketing machine that keeps the whole capitalistic flow of money flowing. And certainly, I don't want to suddenly be poor.
Right. Neither do I. And certainly that's not what I'm advocating, or people who have similar views. The accusation of being unpatriotic is, I find it a little amusing. I believe in democracy, and capitalism often gets in the way of democracy. So I find that the people who want this kind of severe capitalism really don't believe in democracy. That the WTO can make decisions that can override laws passed by the U.S. government, if they're deemed to be a barrier to trade. I keep waiting for something to happen that's going to hit the papers in a big way around this. Most people don't even know this is true. But if Brazil sues the United States or Mexico because we ban tuna fish or something of this sort that's been caught in a certain way, and wins, then the United States either has to pay a huge fine, a crippling fine for the industry, or it would have to change its laws. And so this is not democracy at work in any.
And it's also not the free market that people like to say, we have to protect a free market economy. We're not even close to having a free market economy.
No, we're not. And of course, competition now, say in among media, you can't break in. It's just too expensive, and you have to own media in too many different areas. You have to own computers and TV and movies and video and whatnot. So there's many ways where this system is very unpatriotic in terms of our democracy, but I'd also like to mention that it's completely unsustainable. It's going to use up all the resources that we have. We can't keep growing at this phenomenal rate. And I think people who are within the system just hope for some technological miracles that will somehow or other save us. But in terms of the long view of what's good for the country, you know, it's good for the world, a system that is hell-bent on using up every last drop of resources that we have on the planet for short-term profit is, in my view, incredibly unpatriotic. And if they're willing to sacrifice our children's health and their values and their general well-being along the way, that doesn't make me think better of them.
Yeah,
or make me think that they're very patriotic.
Yeah, I think there are people who, you know, rightly or wrongly, would argue with you about how sustainable this all is, and that, you know, new technologies will emerge that will make it be more sustainable, and you're just a crybaby and a scaredy cat, you know, those kinds of accusations.
Mm-hmm.
But the thing about branding children and marketing to children, it's hard to see how anybody of good conscience and any kind of long-term viewpoint could see that as ultimately a good thing. As I was reading your article, I work in the world of branding, but a new image of branding popped into my head. You know, marketers focus a lot of attention and money on building their brands. And of course, you're right that they want to establish these brand associations in young consumers. The younger, the better, from their point of view. So in essence, I mean, I'm seeing the word branding differently, because in essence, it's almost like cattlemen burning their brand into the hides of cattle. Marketers more and more are seeking to burn their brands into the brains of children.
Yeah, their aim is cradle-to-grave brand loyalty, which is an interesting spin on the word loyalty. Loyalty usually means something that's, you know, deeply heartfelt. But that is a big part of marketing to children, is to hook kids early and then for the rest of their lives. Partly now, we're seeing a lot of adult products advertised to children for that reason. Believe it or not, real estate companies are marketing to children, and we certainly see gasoline companies, you know, those little cute cars in the gasoline ads, and beer ads with frogs. So the idea is not that children are going to necessarily buy these products now, but that they'll both nag their parents to get them, so they'll influence the adult spending, but also as they get older, they'll be loyal to the brand. And we all have jingles that we remember as kids.
We certainly do. I remember going away to college, you know, in a different part of the country, and I think often this is kind of a bonding ritual among young adults of remembering back in childhood, you know, kind of comparing brand memories.
And people your age will have the same memories.
Yeah. And then you feel, you know, you get all excited and it's almost, there's almost like a Freudian dimension here, you know, because Freud had the insight and the psychoanalysts had the insight of how terribly formative the early years were for shaping the personality. And there's a well-known French psychoanalyst, I can't remember his name, but he consults to major corporations, and as part of his methodology, he regresses people back to childhood and explores their earliest associations and memories and smells and so on, in order to help companies then latch on to these for their branding.
Right. Well, now you're moving. If you'd like to, we could talk about the ethics of psychologists participating in marketing research.
Yeah, because, you know, you're a psychologist, and I know that you've been trying to move this issue to the forefront for the American Psychological Association. So maybe you can speak about your efforts and what frustrations and successes you've met so far.
Yeah, and I think the starting point is that this kind of consulting is ethical, or at least it's not unethical in terms of APA. And I like to start off by basically reminding people how we get our knowledge about people. And one of the ways is they come to our office when we're therapists, and they open their hearts up to us, and they reveal their most intimate secrets. And the idea is that we're going to help them, and we're going to take this knowledge in general to help people. And the other major source of knowledge is research. And, you know, here again we get volunteers who believe that they are spending their time and effort because we're going to use this knowledge to help humankind and advance our general understanding of how people work. So when a marketer hires us and says, how can we manipulate children in order to sell to them, and we're really not going to pay attention to any of the side effects. So if we find out that making them feel like dorks, as one marketer said, if they don't buy the product, and that's a very powerful way to children's minds and hearts, is to shame them and make them feel uncool or out of it, then we'll go forward with this because it works. So this is selling this very precious knowledge that we have for a kind of, for a purpose that has nothing to do with helping people, and that in many, many cases, in fact, harms people. And so I basically think this is unethical. And I helped Gary Ruskin collect signatures for a letter he had written. Gary Ruskin is or was the director of Commercial Alert, one of Ralph Nader's groups. And Gary had written a letter asking APA to consider making this kind of consultation unethical. And we got around 40, 50 signatures, and we sent it to APA and got quite a lot of news coverage from USA Today and the New York Times and whatnot, and that resulted in APA setting up a task force that I consulted with. And it turned out that for kind of technical reasons, APA couldn't make it unethical. And I'm not going to go into them, but it has to do with the fact that other therapists, say like psychiatrists and social workers, wouldn't be held to the same standard, and that would be an unfair trade advantage we would be given to these other professions. So
it
gets kind of crazy because we're back to this trade issue. But they didn't do that. They did come out recommending that marketing to children 8 and under, we wanted them to say ban, and they didn't have the political will to say ban, but be restricted. And still, that's a powerful statement that APA is coming out and saying that the marketing is unfair and harmful enough that it ought to be restricted to children of this age. So that was a positive outcome.
But that needs to get translated into legislation to have any real meaning, doesn't it?
It would, and it forms some of the basis for future legislation. I think it may also, to the extent that psychologists who are being trained know about this, it may discourage some of them at least from going this way.
Yeah, I hope
so. But in the meantime, most of the corporations routinely hire psychologists and other professionals to help them.
Yes. There's so much more that we could talk about. One I wanted to touch on before we close off, because time's getting on here. But even young adults are, you know, their brains are still developing. I taught for many years at a university campus, and on our university, I was appalled the way they allow marketers to come in, particularly companies that are pushing credit cards and and cell phones, and they come in and they're signing up kids right and left. And I read in, maybe it was in your paper or maybe it was in the newspaper, the average undergraduate right now is carrying a debt of over $2,000 a month on credit cards. So young people start off in life today immensely in debt as a result of, at least I think in large part, of this marketing.
Right, and just to add to that, the armed forces have been hiring child marketers and marketers who aim at young adults to basically sell the military on campus. So that's another form of marketing that's going on right now. And the other people, of course, who like to market to college students are the beer, you know, and alcohol companies.
Right.
Because they need to get people young, or they'll go bankrupt if they don't replace all the people who are dying with new alcoholics. Then they can't survive. So it's imperative that they reach high school and college students. And I want to repeat that, if they don't reach these youngsters, they can't survive economically, because people who become alcoholic, it's also true of tobacco, most of the people who become addicted to it become addicted young, and a huge amount of the profit or the income that comes from alcohol and from tobacco is from, you know, repeat users, in other words, those who are addicted. So without the young people coming aboard, these companies couldn't survive. So you're right, the college has become, another market, and it's happening all over the campus, the bookstores, every place you go. The college students are also being marketed to.
Yeah, that's true. And even the buildings, the buildings are up, the names are up for sale.
Yeah. And the stadiums.
The stadiums, right. The cultural arts, the cultural arts centers.
Yeah.
Well, to wrap things up here, is there any sort of last summation or thought that you'd like to leave our listeners with?
Yeah. I like to talk a little bit, in my group, my group's called the Campaign for a Commercial Free Childhood. And just to mention that, it's commercialfreechildhood.org. And David, just like you, I've lived long enough to see some things happen that seemed utterly unthinkable when I was young. The collapse of the Soviet Union, the fact that state like Massachusetts would legalize gay marriage. Those things, when we were young, just seemed impossible. And people often say to me, how can you possibly expect the system to change or marketing to children to stop? And that's, of course, what they would like us to think and feel. And I'm actually optimistic that in time, if we keep up our protests and our actions, that we can turn this whole system around. I think we very much need to do so. But you never know what's going to work and when it's going to work and how it's going to play out. So you just have to keep plugging away and doing your best and then letting go, as it were. And I think it's a very worthwhile activity and fight.
Well, I totally agree with you. And Dr. Alan Kanner, thanks so much for being my guest today on Shrink Wrap Radio.
Thank you. It's great being here.
I hope you found this interview with Dr. Alan Kanner to be informative and thought-provoking. Unfortunately, there wasn't time to get to all the questions that I had for him. One area that we didn't get to explore is the way that multinational companies are attempting to gloss over the appearance of spreading a monoculture by doing what they call localization. In one of his articles, Alan writes, and I'll read to you from the article, "Finding ways to appeal to people everywhere is certainly consistent with creating a globalized consumer monoculture, but marketers tout the second major international marketing technique, called localization, as being culturally sensitive and as encouraging diversity. Localization occurs when a multinational corporation infuses local culture into its products, services, and marketing. For example, for its new children's TV channels in India, Disney is producing shows using local television crews, writers, and actors. In the same vein, McDonald's has modified its menu to meet the cultural preferences of different countries, serving cheeseless Big Macs in Israel to keep milk and meat separate, and chilled yogurt drinks in Turkey, while decorating some of its Chinese outlets with paper cuts of auspicious traditional symbols, such as magpies and twin fishes. Kentucky Fried Chicken, which has over 1,000 outlets in China and is adding 200 annually, is serving preserved Sichuan pickle and shredded pork soups. These companies also produce commercials starring local musicians, actors, and other celebrities. In short, localization is a euphemism for the commodification of culture. International marketing campaigns that employ this technique are simply using cultural trappings as a lure, much like draping a beautiful woman over a car in an automobile ad. A cheeseless Big Mac, after all, is still fatty processed food sold by a huge corporation and thus still part of the monoculture. The association of traditional Chinese symbols with fast food is a distortion and cheapening of these emblems. A popular local musician who sings in a McDonald's commercial sends a message to children that it's acceptable to compromise artistic talent to sell out for corporate money." And so it goes on. In another place in his article, Alan cites some chilling statistics from a recent British marketing company. Let me read a bit more from his article. He writes, "A recent report by the British-based marketing company Euromonitor, entitled Marketing to Teenagers, gives a sense of the growing global market. The document is extremely detailed, breaking down teenage spending by geographical region, major countries, types of products, and a host of other variables. From it, we learn that in 2002, teenage expenditures and parents' expenditures on teenagers together amounted to over $220 billion worldwide. Not surprisingly, the United States accounted for the largest market share, 39%, followed by Japan, Germany, and the United Kingdom. The most popular products were computer games, consoles, mobile phones, grazing items, that is, junk food, tobacco products and alcohol, clothing slash footwear, and multicultural recordings. The report describes a world on the brink of the worst global economy in 30 years, yet anticipates a robust adolescent market, predicting that pester power and peer pressures are likely to remain a strong counterbalance to any threat to expenditure levels." Close quote. The report also forecasts that the developed countries will continue to dominate the market in the near future, but adds that, quotes, "nevertheless, the sheer numbers of teenagers in developing markets such as China, India, Indonesia, and Brazil means that only a slight increase in teenage spending can create huge overall growth in global teenage markets." And so I'll stop reading there, but if you're interested in reading the entire article, and it's not terribly long, I'll post a link to the PDF file in the show notes on the Shrink Wrap Radio website.
Let us all come together to see what we can find. Shrink Wrap Radio is here to remind you it's all in your mind. Let us all remember what you seek is what you find. And Dr. Dave is here to remind you it's all in your mind. Exploring our spirit and our psyche, we are learning to unwind. Shrink Wrap Radio is here to remind you it's all in your mind. We're all in your mind. We're all in your mind.
Thanks again to the inimitable Jeff Smith for putting that to music for me. This was the short version you just heard. The version I played two episodes ago was longer, with a musical bridge and an extra verse. I don't want to tax you too much, so I'll be sticking with the shorter version most times when I play it here. So I'm all in your mind, and on our poll, which is on the website, I'm asking you how much you worry. 20 people have answered, but if I don't hear from more of you, I might, well, start to worry. In the past, I've received a couple of listener requests to interview Dr. William Glasser, originator of the approach known as reality therapy. Well, I have interviewed him, and that interview is now up on my Wise Counsel series at wisecounselpodcast.com. Most recently, he and his wife have collaborated on a book to help folks with troubled marriages. And you can not only listen to that interview, but you can also download a free transcript. Also, let me remind you about Shrink Wrap Radio Fan Club. It's on Facebook, and there's a link to it in the green gutter area on the right-hand side of the Shrink Wrap Radio website. I took a peek there just now, and I see that 10 people have joined the fan club and have made a comment there. Let me hasten to add that the fan club was not my idea. It was created by listener Susie, and of course, I'm flattered but not so egotistical as to create my own fan club. However, it's a great place for you to dialogue with other listeners, and I hope it will become a sort of community watering hole for the Shrink Wrap Radio community. And there is a growing community out there. One of my colleagues at Sonoma State University invited me to speak to his class this past week. His class is on nonviolent communication. In fact, the teacher is Shepherd Bliss, who you might recall that I interviewed some time back on Sweet Darkness. Well, I was delighted to discover a regular listener in that class. So, hi to Nick, if you're listening now. It was great meeting you, and I enjoyed my meeting with the class. And then the very next day, I drove 3 hours each way to speak to the psychology club at San Joaquin Delta College as the result of an invitation from another listener, Jeremy. We had a great session, and I think I'll turn that into the next podcast, so you might want to hear that. And speaking of fans, I told you last time that I'm a big movie fan and that I'm really excited to be part of Podshow's promotion for the upcoming Sony Pictures movie We Own the Night. It's coming out quite soon, actually. I just learned that the release date is October 12, 2007. Obviously, I haven't seen it yet, but I've read a little about the plot. And without giving the plot away, I hate it when reviewers give the plot away. So without giving the plot away, I can tell you that it does involve one character trying to save another from the Russian mafia. I actually went to the movies last night, and the plot of that film also revolved around the Russian mob in America. The movie going and book reading public in this country has long had a fascination with the mob. And I had an insight last night after that movie that we're in the midst of a shift. It used to always be about the Italian mafia, but now I think we're going to be seeing more and more movies and TV shows in which the villains are Russian rather than Italian mobsters. You heard that prediction here first. I was interested in how the movie last night focused not only on the violence, but also on the backdrop of the mobsters' strong family ties and their affection for the old country. It's The Sopranos all over again, Russian style. So I'm curious to see how We Own the Night will portray the Russian mob. And speaking of sponsors, the sponsors for this show, of course, are Podshow and GoDaddy. Remember to use the code SHRINK3 at checkout from GoDaddy to get a discount on your next domain name or web hosting purchase at GoDaddy.com.
Just to bridge from one part of the show to another, I put in these little short clips from people.
Yeah.
Okay, so just read it.
Hi, this is Anita Leutold from Switzerland, from St. Gallen, at the IASD Dream Conference, and you're in a dream with Dr. Dave.
Thank you.
That's okay.
That's it.
Thanks, Anita from Switzerland. And that's a signal to dip into our email bag. The first comes from Elizabeth in Germany, who writes, "Dear Dave, the kids, all three, are invited to birthday parties this Saturday afternoon, leaving me the opportunity to write and leave some comments about your latest shows. Firstly, I really enjoyed getting a sampler version of the APA convention. For those of us too far away, in my case, Germany, to actually attend the conference, it affords us the opportunity to get a taste of what it must be like to be there. Thank you for reading out Mary Pfeiffer's eloquent letter in which she explains her decision to return her presidential citation to the APA. As healers, psychologists must distance themselves from any involvement in military interrogations and methods of torture. Personally, as an American and as a psychologist, it greatly pains me to think that the APA is not willing to unequivocally come out against psychologists being involved in any way in torture, even in the training of others in the, quotes, best, close quotes, methods to psychologically wear people down. I was very impressed with Joni Gillespie, show number 104, and the discussion of her book, Cyber Rules. I'm actually considering buying her book to help me with the transition of my own children from childhood to becoming teenagers in the cyber age. I recently had quite a heated discussion with my mother, age 63, about what she considers to be the rapid decline of moral values in America. I tried to point out the fact that immoral behavior, however we want to define that, crime, child abuse, pornography, domestic abuse, etc., existed to the same extent when she was growing up in the 40s and 50s, but people tended not to talk about it. She also insisted that the internet is in some way to blame for this decline, for example, the spread of internet pornography. The advance of new technology has always gone along with criticism of its corrupting influence. Joni Gillespie makes it clear that the internet is a tool which can be used both negatively and positively. As parents, we need to guide our children to becoming discerning users. Her analogy of teaching a child to use the internet as being similar to teaching a child to cross the street was an excellent one. Then she goes on to say, I have two suggestions for possible guests. I was at a conference for psychotherapists in June on the topic of mindfulness, acceptance, and empathy in psychotherapy. The leading speaker was John Kabat-Zinn, a leading researcher in the use of mindfulness based stress reduction, and former director of the Stress Reduction Clinic. He was quite a powerful and convincing speaker. At the moment, I'm reading the book he co-authored with his wife, Myla, Everyday Blessings, The Inner Work of Mindful Parenting. The examples they give of mindfulness in the everyday situations with children are quite inspirational. My second suggestion is Louise Richardson, the author of What Terrorists Want, Understanding the Enemy and Containing the Threat. I listened to her discuss her book as a guest lecturer for the course Issues in Foreign Policy After 9/11 at Berkeley. Her discussion of what motivates terrorists to do what they do was very insightful, and I could imagine she would make an excellent guest. Once again, thank you for all your hard work and commitment to your podcast. It's greatly appreciated. All the best, and she signs it Beth in Erlangen, Germany. Beth, thanks so much for writing and for those two excellent guest suggestions. I'm very interested in both. Actually, Jon Kabat-Zinn has been suggested to me multiple times and is on my to-do list. And I am very interested in the psychological dimensions of terrorism and had not heard of the author that you suggested. So I hope to follow up on both of those. The next one reads, Dear Dr. Dave, I filled out the survey before I had listened to the Spiritual Emergencies podcast. This is something of what I had suggested for a show, so thank you very much for this. I have known a number of excellent people who have needlessly been ravaged by psychiatric drugs, so this issue is a poignant one for me. One day, future generations will look upon our use of psychiatric drugs as a horrible and primitive barbarity. I am especially horrified by the numbers of children who are being put on drugs now. Maria. Maria, thanks so much for that, and I agree. Next, we have greetings. I'm also a runner listener. This is in reference to someone else who wrote in that she was listening during her runs, and I said, oh, that opens up a whole new audience for me. So I think this message from Carol is in response to that. Greetings. I'm also a runner listener. I liked your last show on George Bush. I'm a French-Canadian and don't have a strong political position, but I like the analysis on real people. Carol. Thank you, Carol. Next, Dr. Dave, I'm a listener, been listening since episode 99. My newish girlfriend told me that she has a codependency addiction as well as love and sex addiction. The Google links don't really tell me anything for the latter. As to the former, I've gotten a lot of resources, some of which are contradictory. Furthermore, there's my own personal belief of all these syndromes, Asperger's, which I suffer from, according to my workplace's physician, attention deficit disorder, and so on, are created by the drug companies to sell product. While I'm certain that such things as ADD, Asperger's, codependency, ADHD do indeed exist, I think they're overdiagnosed in this country. That said, I don't want to assume it's always overdramatized, so I would appreciate a show on how to deal with the two conditions mentioned above. Many thanks. Hassan. Hassan, thanks so much for writing. And of course, I can't do diagnosis or treatment on a show like this. I can make sort of general sorts of comments. I would like to refer you to my Wise Counsel podcast, in which I have interviewed people about Asperger's and about attention deficit disorder. And I'll try to get more guests on Shrink Wrap Radio as well that touch on these. It's interesting to me that you're getting diagnosed at work. I think that's, I don't know. To me, that seems like an unusual situation. I do agree, I think, with your assessment that some of these diagnoses are perhaps tossed around too easily and overused. At the same time, I also agree with you that I think there are some very real underlying conditions, and so it does require a very discriminating approach to diagnosis and treatment, and I hope that you and your girlfriend are seeking out the very best that you can find. So I think that better wrap it up for the email today. Did I mention that you can find out more about the forthcoming movie, We Own the Night, by going to their website at www.sonypictures.com/movies/We Own the Night? Last episode, I mentioned that Mark Wahlberg is in the film and how much I've been enjoying his work in recent movies. Well, Robert Duvall is also one of the stars. You might recall that he received an Oscar for Best Male Leading Actor in 1984's Tender Mercies. In addition to winning the Oscar once, he's been nominated for it five other times. Three of those nominations were for unforgettable roles in Apocalypse Now, The Great Santini, and The Godfather. Can anyone forget him in those opening scenes of Apocalypse Now with a chopper, when the choppers come swooping down on the attack and they're playing that loud music? And in The Great Santini, he really captures the archetypal role of the rigid and dominating military father. Now, no wonder he's so able to portray these military types so powerfully. He's the son of an admiral, and he himself also fought in the Korean War. In addition to We Own the Night, this prolific actor is in at least four other films this year alone. So I'm looking forward to seeing what he does when We Own the Night comes out on October 12th. Thanks again to Dr. Alan Kanner for sharing his work on globalization and the commercialization of childhood. Our next episode will feature my interactive presentation to the Psychology Club of the San Joaquin Valley Delta College in California. Until then, this is Dr. Dave saying, it's all in your mind.